This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by Film Movement Plus. It's Emmanuel DeVoe week on Film Movement Plus.
And there's why not?
This is the North American debut from filmmaker Philippe Fausson, mm-hmm. who made Fatima a few years back. This film is called Amin, and it stars DeVoe in a drama about a Senegalese immigrant's struggle to find a meaningful life as he works in France. She plays the woman who enters his life. The man is played by Mustapha Mbenge. He's the title character. Mm. And they're comparing this film. Critics have compared this film and Fausson to Ken Loach and Stéphane Brisé, who made At War 2 years ago. And this film was part of the Cannes Directors Fortnight.
So
I definitely want to watch this. Like I said, it is Emmanuel DeVoe week at Film Movement Plus. The other titles they have for you. Mocha from Frederick Mermoux. It says, overwhelmed with grief, Diane Kramer, played by DeVoe, travels to Evian in search of a mocha-colored Mercedes that she believed killed her son in a hit-and-run accident. She tracks down Marlena Natalie Bai, who is the owner of the vehicle, and then some revenge goes down.
Oh.
The last one sounds wild, and I will probably watch it first. it's called If You Don't, I Will. It's from Sophie
Filière.
Say it again.
Filière.
You took French in high school. I did not. Anyway, there's no passion or spontaneity anymore for Pomme, Emmanuel DeVoe, and Pierre, Matthew Amalric. So one afternoon, while on a hike in the wilderness, Pomme declares her independence by deciding to stay in the woods rather than return to her underwhelming life with Pierre.
Ouch.
That's right. And I like that idea.
Oh, do you?
She becomes the Grizzly Adams lady of France.
And that's just some of the many amazing titles you will find on Film Movement Plus, offering an extraordinary mix of indie and art house and international documentary, feature, and short. You name it. They've got the deep cuts. They've got the good stuff. They've got the director's Fortnite films, which is, you know, if you're looking for a stamp of quality, that's one of the good ones.
There's also one more thing that happens on Film Movement Plus this week. In celebration of Human Rights Day on December 10th, the film Advocate by Rachel Leah Jones and Philippe Bellesh. It is the story of Leah
Semmel.
She has, since the 1970s, made a career out of defending Palestinians in Israeli courts. And this is a documentary about her.
All right.
That'll be fascinating.
For sure. The folks at Film Movement Plus are lovely, lovely people, and especially adore a Linoleum Knife listener, because they are offering you this special deal. You get a 30-day free trial plus 50% off your first three paid months. Just use the promo code KNIFE at checkout. That's KNIFE when you are checking out at filmmovementplus.com. A podcast of the cinema.
Tell people what we are and who we think we are and what we think we're doing here.
Mr. Big Stuff. You are Dave White. You are a film critic. I am Alonzo Duraldi. I'm a film critic. We're married to each other. I am the reviews editor at The Wrap and co-host of three other podcasts, Breakfast All Day, Who Shot Ya, and A Film and a Movie.
I want to thank the anonymous person who sent us the Marie Bell Holiday Ganache.
Yes.
Collection of little painted chocolates.
I like a ganache, and you put a holiday as an adjective on anything, and I'm right
I'm
there.
Announcing this here because you did not sign a note. You just said, thanks, David Alonzo, for the podcast, but we don't know who you are. Maybe you like it that way. It will keep me up at night. That's fine. But thank you.
Enjoy it listen, in anonymity.
Anything keeps me up at night.
I was really. Going to say, it's a low bar.
It doesn't take much. Perhaps you are aware, and if you're not, it's fine too, that we have postponed this episode for a bit, as we announced on the Patreon page and on Facebook and Twitter. One of our friends died, and we just learned about it, and so I needed a minute to collect myself before going through and doing this show. Our friend L.D. Bechtel, he is a New York-based musician and writer. He was most well known for being part of the Magnetic Fields, the band, and for singing a handful of songs on the 69 Love Songs album, their most well known record. And he wrote the 33 and a third book about 69 Love Songs. He designed the album's packaging, so he was part of that. That group of folks. I've known him for about 18 years. We don't know the details of his death, only that before the official news broke, the telephone text chain passed it on to us.
He was a friend and a colleague. The one time I was ever published in the Village Voice was because
same here.
LD hired me to do some pieces.
LD did that as well for me, So it would be weird. It would be weirder to not talk about it, I think, than to talk about it. When this has happened in my life, what I know about me personally, when a friend dies, I spend a chunk of time, several days, a week, whatever, feeling just that punch in the stomach kind of feeling where you don't know what you're supposed to think or do or be. In that time, I just feel sort of like I've been stunned by something and I don't have feelings yet about it, none that I have articulated or can speak about. And that what I have learned is that what I do is I just kind of trudge forward and do my tasks and do my job until I can sit down and sort out what I, how I'm going to react to it. Right now, the detail-oriented person in me is craving information, which we don't seem to have yet.
Yeah.
I knew that he had had COVID at one point in the past few months. He recovered. I don't know if that had anything to do with this. I just, it is sad. I am sad. I don't know what else to say. Why don't we just talk about movies?
Okay.
Shall we begin with Mank?
Oh, sure. Why not? This is the latest from David Fincher. Based on a screenplay that's written by Fincher's late father, Jack, some time ago, so I imagine...
Yeah, because he died in 2003-ish.
Yeah, so I imagine Fincher the Younger, has done some work on it in the ensuing years, but is not credited. And it is the story... Basically, it's the Citizen Kane origin story. It's about screenwriter Herman J. Mankiewicz, played by Gary Oldman, at a point in his career when his alcoholism had made it more and more difficult for him to find work, but being hired by brash young Orson Welles, making his film debut to write this screenplay, and basically Mank is off in this house in the desert, far from Hollywood, drying out and mending a broken leg and cranking out this screenplay with occasional visits from producer John Houseman, who keeps telling him to hurry up, and a lot of flashbacks to his glory days in Hollywood, to Mank's friendship with Marion Davis and with her benefactor, William Randolph Hearst, who would, of course, be the subject, essentially, of Citizen Kane. And Yeah, it's the further away from it I get, the more kind of middling I am about it. I think when I first saw it, it's very easy to be taken in by the spectacle of it all. This is a creamy black and white movie with lots of recreations of, you know, Hollywood in the 30s and the, you know, when the back when the Sony lot was the MGM lot, then you could actually enter it off of Washington. I forget which boulevard that is, whatever.
Well, it's surrounded by four, so
that gate that they don't longer use anymore, but you know, they used to, and so they do
that
in the movie.
Seven people listening to the show know what we're talking about.
Sure, right. But nonetheless, okay. And you know, there are some terrific performances. Amanda Seyfried as Marion Davies is great. Like, a movie about her would have been most welcome.
we can talk about that in a moment, but yes.
You know, it's hard for me to wrap my head around this, because the things that I liked about it the most as a sort of Hollywood history turn out to be completely made up, and that's okay. And that's a thing that you do in biopics. I understand but in talking to our friend Ben Mankiewicz, who is the grandson of Herman Mankiewicz and a fan of this film, he sort of, you know, we talked about it on Breakfast All Day, kind of gave a roadmap of, oh, yeah, well, that didn't happen. That really wasn't a thing. No, not so much this.
Right.
And so you're kind of left with, like, well, then what are we talking about here? And why did all these things happen, if not in the way that this movie outlines them? You know, I've had several people ask me, do I need to see Citizen Kane first?
It wouldn't hurt.
It wouldn't hurt. If you've never seen it, you should see it. Like, there's never
really
a bad time to see Citizen Kane.
It's a really great movie.
Yeah, you know, it is, there's a reason why it has become kind of the default best movie ever made. Why, for years on the Sight and Sound poll, it would always win. It is probably still my favorite movie. And I think of the kind of the canon of classics that you're supposed to watch, it's one of the most fun. Like, it's a funny movie, and it has great, it just zips along, and it's really well put together. It's not Broccoli.
Question.
Yes.
When you were 11.
Yes.
And you demanded that your mother drive you across town to the Repertory Cinema in Atlanta.
Yes.
So that she could take you to see Citizen Kane.
Yes.
What did you get when you were that age? Because I watched it too young and was bored and fell asleep.
Well, here's the thing.
I watched it later as an adult and realized
it's great.
This is a fantastic film.
I mean, obviously, I did not get as much out of it as I eventually would on that first viewing. But on that first viewing, one of the reasons that I had wanted to see it was because I'd read so much about it.
Right.
And I had read, and a lot of the film books that I was reading at that time that came out in the 70s had no compunction about just telling you the entire plot.
Right.
So I knew the whole story going in. I knew what Rosebud was.
Right.
You know, and so,
well, we grew up reading Peanuts.
They also spoiled that one.
Linus and Lucy spoiled that thing immediately.
Yes.
Before you, when you're seven. And you're like, okay, I guess that's a, all right, sure. Yeah.
But yeah, so, like, you know, when I read, like, you know, 50 great, I forget what this book is called. I have a copy of it somewhere. But yeah, they walk you through the whole thing. So I knew what I was getting going in as far as what the structure was going to be. I just thought it was, you know, a heck of a picture. You know, it was an entertaining.
Is that in fact what you said to your mother upon exiting?
It is not.
That was a heck of a picture, Mom.
Yeah, I did not talk like.
I don't make them like that anymore.
An old school mogul. But no, it was entertaining. I followed it. I thought it was, you know, it was perfectly fine. And then it wasn't until much later that I really learned about, like, oh, let's talk about Greg Toland and depth of focus, and, you know, the fact that there are ceilings on these sets and he's shooting up at an angle, and, you know, the Hearst connections and all the other stuff, like, that would all come later.
Your mother, on the other hand, thought to herself, my 11-year-old is an aesthete and therefore most likely going to be a homosexual. We will deal with this later.
She probably had that thought at various points in my childhood. I don't know if Citizen Kane was one of the prompts to it. But,
right.
You know. So, yeah, this is... I'm still sorting out, I guess, my feelings about this movie. I mean, I've reviewed it already. I had to kind of crank one out quickly because, you know, it opened theatrically weeks ago. But, you know, it's worth seeing for the things that it does well. I think, just go in with the usual, you know, galoshes that one wears to get through a biopic and just know that, like, most of this is made up.
Right. But it's made up in a way that I found pretty entertaining.
Oh, sure.
I like that it, you know, played around with traditional narrative, just like Citizen Kane did. That it is a, I like that it's a film for people who love old Hollywood or just think they love it, maybe. People who know Citizen Kane, who know why it matters. I think they would find this worth looking at, too. It's a bit too cool, temperature-wise, for me.
It lacks a beating heart in a lot of ways.
But that is something that you get with David Fincher quite often. Yeah. And that is something that I expect from him. I expect a kind of technical mastery and emotionality lagging behind. And sometimes it works really well and in films that I think are incredible. And then here, sometimes it works in a way that that when it's over, I think, well, that was good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Herman Mankiewicz himself was too cool, but not temperature-wise. He was just too cool for the jobs he took. You know, he was combative and adversarial with his bosses. He sort of dared them to discard him. But he didn't need them to do it. He was capable of basically almost doing that himself. He was a very alcoholic person.
Yes.
But who also seemed to function well in that state of being, which is not the usual story that you see about, you know, people with drinking problems in film and television. I also appreciated that it is about the political world that we experience right now.
Yes.
Even though what we are witnessing is the politics of the 30s, where the, you know, the moneyed, powerful white men keep life good for themselves by screwing anyone who got in the way of that, even and especially their own employees. That is absolutely, you know, a shout out to 2020. And
I mean, it's about the nexus of show business, politics, and the media, which, again, so is Citizen Kane.
Right, right. And so is Donald Trump.
Yes.
Yeah. So regarding Marion Davies, Davies or Davis?
It's spelled Davies. I think you say it that way. I know, like, if you were British, they would say Davis, but, you know.
Anyway, I like Amanda Seyfried in this as her. Again, who knows if that's how this person really was off screen.
It jibes with a lot of what I've read about her.
One thing I did enjoy was her her ability to say the right thing at exactly the wrong time. Say the truth at exactly the wrong time, which is, you know, something to get stuck in the wheels.
Yeah.
And that was kind of how she functioned. As I watched the film, though, I was a little distracted by the idea that you mentioned earlier. What if a movie about her, where she's the focus and all these dudes are just in her orbit? What is she thinking about all of this? And how is she experiencing a kind of powerlessness, but also, you know, a very determined ambition to, you know, attach herself to it.
Anita Loos famously wrote about Marion Davies that more gold was showered upon her than of all the gold diggers of the 1920s,
right,
and she never had to dig.
Right, and she seemed to, you know, care enough about it to go after it.
Yeah,
but also to love Hearst.
She did.
And that is, you know, That is an element of this story that I hope is true. I mean, she stayed with him till the end. I
Yeah,
know that.
that's what I've always read. And also there's the thing about her career is that it probably would have gone better had he not directly interfered so much, because even though he was bankrolling her movies, he always wanted to put her in these like stuffy character roles, and her wheelhouse was light comedy. And so if he just backed off and made those let those movies happen, and with directors who understood what to do with her and play to her strengths, she might have been a bigger star than she was, in these elephantine expensive movies that he was totally paying for, but that no one wanted to go see.
So, this is a gorgeous looking historical dramedy. It's quite funny. The one-liners that come out of Oldman's mouth are good ones, and you expect a guy like him to walk through life that way, popping off, quips at people all the time. I know a person like that.
What, me? I was gonna say, like, I think at first
Come
blush,
on now.
I found him a little too, one-armed bandit joke machine. But as Drea,
You are not a one-armed bandit joke machine,
thank you.
but you have a lot at the ready
Yeah.
in ways that I just don't.
Fair enough.
Like I can sit down and write something, but you've always got something simmering off the top of your head, and I just think he goes so fast. My brain does not move in this way.
I didn't quite buy it at first, but then Drea, when we talked about this on Who Shot You, pointed out that it is very much the way an addict goes through life, which is to be glib and to always have like a one-liner to deflect, deflect, deflect.
Some addicts,
Yeah, not all of
witty,
them.
witty addicts.
Yes, but those who
The ones
can.
I knew in my childhood were not witty
Fair
at
enough.
all.
But the ones who have the capability of using humor as a coping mechanism are coping like crazy.
So I love looking at this movie. I like the experience of it. It is probably completely ahistorical, even though it is simultaneously grounded in a very deep researched knowledge of this world and what happened. So, like, Fincher knew what really happened, and then decided, yeah, but this is the story I'm going to
It
tell
basically,
anyway.
yeah, and it also digs into the whole Pauline Kael inspired, did Welles write any of Citizen Kane debate, and ultimately I don't care because the greatness of Citizen Kane obviously starts with the screenplay, but it doesn't end with the screenplay. So even if Mankiewicz wrote the entire thing from stem to stern, Welles brings in a whole lot of other stuff that make the movie a classic.
Film language. That's they were collaborators. So anyway, if you want history, go read a book.
There you go.
But this is an interpretation of a moment in time and one man's, drunken stumble through it.
Also, the women in the movie are closer in age to Mankiewicz than the actresses in the movie are to Oldman, but that's
So
Hollywood.
Oldman is playing significantly younger,
Than himself.
even though he doesn't look significantly younger. He looks beaten down.
Right. Well, it's that thing of, he's meant to play a ravaged, what, 43 or something? He says his age at one point.
Approximately, yeah.
Which is the opposite of like Jessica Lange and Susan Sarandon playing much younger than themselves in Duel, because they look great for their age,
I don't know. People are still pretty cute at 43.
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean, look at me. I'm 56. How adorable am I?
Hubba hubba.
It's a life of not drinking too much of the booze.
That's true.
Yeah.
And lots of water.
And lots of butter.
Also that.
Alonzo, please talk about Ovid.
Oh, I would be happy
Do
to.
that, please, for me.
Yes.
Just for me, not for anyone else.
Okay.
Not even for Ovid. Please do it for me.
So, first of all, it is the holiday season. So hoop-de-doo and Dickory Dock.
Yeah, don't forget to hang up your sock.
Indeed. So if you're trying to figure out, hey, what do I get for the film lover in my life who seemingly has everything, maybe that film lover doesn't have Ovid.tv. And if you want to give them a gift subscription, you have a couple of options. You could get them an entire year for $69.99 or an exclusive deal that you can only get as a gift subscription, 3 months for
$19.99. Oh.
So, you know, it's like they give them that little taste, get them hooked. And then
that's a $20 gift, and yeah, they're going to get to watch a lot of cool movies for 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, as always, lots of stuff going on there. By the way, also check out their new blog, Metafilm, which is a very far-reaching talk about, you know, look at the current cinema. And so, you know, if you're the kind of person who is listening to this show, then you're the kind of person who wants to read that. But also, they got new releases this week and every week. Raul Opaz Pastrana's Border South, a vivid portrait of the thousands of immigrants who disappear along the trail trying to cross the border from Mexico to the United States. Laurie Miller's Day One chronicles Middle Eastern and African teen refugees who were guided through a program of healing by devoted education at a unique St. Louis public school. Hmm. Also, Michael Rubo's Sad Song of Yellow Skin, a film about the people of Saigon, told through the experiences of three young American journalists, which joins his other fantastic documentary on Ovid, Waiting for Fidel, which we mentioned recently.
Yes.
For lovers of Latin American cinema, there's also from Mexico, Matias Meyer's Yo, starring Aurel Silva as a 15-year-old with limited mental skills who befriends an 11-year-old girl. Juan Schnitzman's El Incendio from Argentina, Aspirantes from Brazil, and much, much more. All at Ovid.tv. And hey, if you are a Linoleum Knife listener, and you are, they've got a sweet, sweet deal for you. Use the code Linoleum for 50% off the first 3 months when you check out at Ovid.tv. That's Linoleum, L-I-N-O-L-E-U-M, at Ovid, O-V as in Victor, I-D as in David, .tv.
Guess what?
What?
You saw a film I didn't see.
As is often the case.
Often the case.
But you, and you see ones I don't see also.
Yeah, that's right. You just, yeah. Godfather the Third.
Yes.
The remix.
Yeah, no kidding. The Godfather, comma, coda, colon, the death of Michael Corleone.
Wait, say that again.
The Godfather, comma, coda.
The Godfather, comma, coda.
Colon.
Colon.
The death of Michael Corleone.
Is there a three replacing an E anywhere in the title?
Sadly, no.
There should be.
Right. The Throdfather or something, yeah. So yeah, this is 1990s.
The Third Father.
There you go. This is 1990s The Godfather Part 3. Chopped and channeled again. I haven't followed the full history of this movie. I know that after I watched Coda, I went to iTunes to sort of look at the previous edit of the film. And the one they had on iTunes was called The Godfather 3, colon, The Coppola Restoration or something. And I'm like, oh, okay. So you've already had your hands in on this one. But on the heels of last year's Cotton Club Encore, Francis Coppola has returned to another one of his less successful films. And tried to bring out its best. And, you know, I think there are improvements, certainly, and there are things that I've liked about this movie all along, and then stuff that just still doesn't work. But anyway, for those who don't remember, this is set in the late 70s, even though it looks totally 1990 throughout. And
it's never explained.
It's never explained, no.
It's so weird, anyway.
Because they do the 40s and the 50s pretty well in the first two Godfathers,
right.
But yeah, Somehow in this one they kind of drop the ball. Anyway, so Michael, played by Al Pacino, is looking to go legit. The family has sold the casinos. They are getting out of everything that is remotely tied to organized crime. They've handed over day-to-day operations to a guy named Joey Zaza. And you know, they are in the process of floating a huge loan to the Vatican Bank, which is facing a crippling debt in exchange for getting controlling interest in a European corporation. Obviously, none of this goes smoothly. His nephew, played by Andy Garcia, had been a lieutenant for Joey Zaza, but he gets brought in on family stuff. And he's a nephew with an asterisk because he is the son, the out-of-wedlock son of Sonny Corleone, who's played by James Caan in the original film. And this is the one where Sofia Coppola plays Michael's daughter, Mary, and she is a great filmmaker.
She is a great filmmaker, and I remember when we first moved to Los Angeles, I was writing reviews for a website called iFilm that is not in operation anymore. But in addition to reviewing films, they would send me to the junket days. Now, a junket is when a bunch of journalists go to a hotel and sit around a big table, and they bring the talent in, and you lob questions. And there's no rhyme or reason to how it happens. You better get yours in if you want to get one in. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a press conference where everyone's like, blah, 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 you know, like, hey, answer mine, you know. I went to the junket for the Virgin Suicides.
Yes.
And they brought Sofia Coppola and Kirsten Dunst into the room. And someone asked Sofia Coppola the question.
Yeah.
About Godfather 3, which I felt was entirely inappropriate.
She had been out of the spotlight since Godfather 3.
That is correct. I still think it was an inappropriate question.
Fair enough.
And so did Kirsten Dunst. And I'll tell you, Kirsten Dunst got my lifelong respect that day for jumping in to answer the question. The question was directed at Sofia Coppola.
Uh-huh.
And Kirsten Dunst said, you know what? Winona dropped out. Her dad asked her to do a favor for him. And she did.
And that is why they sent them back together.
That's the answer to the question. Like, dead stop. And I was like, ooh, girl. Good. Good one. That's a good one.
That's because usually at junkets, they send them out one at a time. But sometimes when, like, one of them doesn't want to have to answer that question, they send out two so the other one can, like, step up.
It began making sense to me during the course of the junket because Sofia Coppola is, on that day at least, she was, and my understanding is that she remains to this kind of person, soft-spoken.
Yes.
And shy.
Yeah.
And it would appear to be the case that Kirsten Dunst is neither of those things.
Well, she's a lifer.
And that, exactly. And so I was just, first of all, I love The Virgin Suicides. Yeah. And dig Sofia Coppola as a filmmaker and you know, obviously Kirsten Dunst smacking people down. Her performance in this film is a struggle for her. She's doing her best.
Yes.
She's not an actress.
It hasn't gotten any better in 30 years.
No.
But, you know.
How could it?
Yeah, but you understand.
I'm sure they chopped a lot of it out, but
it has a feel of that.
But she's got a main supporting role.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you know, her. Oh, look, it's 3 decades later. I can do a spoiler.
Yeah.
Her death is a very big deal, and it's yeah. supposed to be a very big deal. And unfortunately, that is diminished because she's not an actress.
But right.
She is a filmmaker, and I'm glad that she is, you know. That she got to that path and she's
right.
she's killing it. And I wrote a thing once about like people who do movies with their fathers before they were ready, but then later bounce back. You know, Angelica Houston famously did this terrible John Huston movie in the late 60s called A Walk with Love and Death.
Oh my.
And she was not an actress yet, but she's right. one now. Right. You know, Jaden Smith is turning out to be really interesting. More than we expected he would have been after seeing
Karate
after
Kid.
After Earth.
Well, sure.
That's the one he did with his dad.
Right.
Anyway, but he's, you know, he's good in Skate Kitchen. Mm-hmm. He's an interesting figure in the culture right now.
Yeah.
So, But, you know, I think Andy Garcia is still really great in this movie. I think Talia Shire is... Oh! when she is looking through the opera glasses and watching somebody eat a poisoned cannoli, it's just like, oh, I want to move into that, you know? So, yeah. So there's there are things I like about this movie. And the changes, I think, are good ones. They've taken out the opening scene was really this sort of lengthy church ceremony where Michael is being given this medal by the Vatican. And now he's actually having a meeting at the Vatican with this archbishop and talking about the money stuff. And George Hamilton is the consigliere. And, you know, so that works really well. And they changed the ending in a way that I think is also more effective. So if you are a Godfather fan, if you're a Godfather completist, if you like to watch the 10,000 versions of all of his movies that Coppola likes to do, I think we're up to 8 Apocalypse Nows by this point.
No.
At least 3.
3, maybe.
At least.
All right.
Anyway, it's worth checking out. It is, it's on Blu-ray and streaming on digital. The Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone.
We watched a documentary.
Yes.
Called Dear Santa. Mm-hmm. That is unreviewable.
It's funny. Recently, our friend Amy Nicholson talked about how Kurt Vonnegut said about Love Story back in the day that it was like trying to review a chocolate eclair.
Right.
To try to pick apart what doesn't work about it. This movie
I
is
know
so,
what doesn't work about this documentary.
Me too.
There's not one element of dramatic tension.
That
there is nothing that makes you wonder what's coming next. It is an 80-minute
advertisement for niceness.
Advertisement for wonderful, kind activities at Christmas time.
And the movie can't get into as much detail about the mechanics of what it's talking about
because
it wants to be suitable for every audience member, no matter what they might think about Santa.
Right. For example, right now, if you're listening to this podcast with your little children in the car, here's what we will tell you about this film. That Santa Claus runs the entire operation.
Yes, he is much discussed by the people who are participating.
Santa Claus is an employee, or at least a consultant, for the United States Postal Service.
Well, no, the Postal Service is a consultant to Santa. Let's
or
be clear.
Something like that. It's a collab.
It is.
Right?
Santa X USPS.
So everyone on camera talks about all the things that they do for Santa.
Yes.
And how many times they talked to Santa today to get his opinions about the project. Now, the project is children write letters to Santa Claus.
Sometimes adults.
Sometimes adults are writing letters to Santa Claus, and those letters are collected. And Santa's many helpers across the United States get the people the things they ask for in those letters.
Yes.
At least one of the things.
Yes.
And the documentary is about how that happens. The documentary is also about how you can participate if you want to. At the very end, they give you
if you want to go
information about how to be a helper for Santa Claus.
You could go to USPSOperationSanta.com/letters.
Yeah. Now, having said that it's unreviewable, because what are you going to say? It sucks? No. having said that it's unreviewable, I will tell you that it moved me anyway.
It is. You can't.
There's a moment
not
near the end
oh
where this kid gets a thing that he asked for, and his little sister is seemingly more invested in it than he is. Like, he's super into it, but she is giving you, like, they're using her face to advertise this film. The look of, on her face.
Yeah.
It is the look that baby little Mara Wilson gives in the remake of Miracle on 34th Street, that face.
Yeah.
That you cannot act.
Right.
You know, or I guess Mara Wilson.
I was going to say, unless you're Mara Wilson.
But, and it caught me. That the pleasure that this child took at her brother getting the thing he wanted,
yeah,
and from Santa's helpers,
and the stories of the adults who are working with Santa, who talk right. about their own childhoods and how somebody did this thing for them and it made a difference, and so now they want to bring that same feeling to other people. Like that, this is an unreviewable movie. It is lovely, and
it's very sweet.
As our friend Matt Atchity would say, it does what it says on the box.
Right. If you want to feel good,
yeah,
and then you want to feel inspired to go do something nice for somebody.
Absolutely.
This is the movie.
Yeah.
This is it. Hey, we have another movie to talk about.
Oh.
Yeah. I saw it. You didn't.
Okay.
There has been a restoration of Hu Hsiao-hsien's 1998 film, Flowers of Shanghai.
Okay.
It is a, you know, a beautifully restored, you know, 4K situation. Mm. And it is currently in virtual cinemas. Well, it's in one virtual cinema. It's at Film Forum, New York's Film Forum. So if you go online, you want to watch this, Flowers of Shanghai, Film Forum, NYC. Yeah. So now you remember seeing The Assassin with me.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And how...
little assassinating there was?
How very little assassinating there was. Yes. We'll get to that in a bit.
Are there no flowers in this movie?
There are women in this movie.
Oh.
Okay. So it stars Tony Leung.
Oh.
Yep. And Michiko Hada, who was a big star in Japan. She was in a film from the 90s that you really like, The Mystery of Rampo.
Oh, yeah.
So Tony Leung's character, this is all set at turn of the 20th century, Shanghai.
Oh, I love Tony Leung in a period suit.
And well, this is, you know, a costume, you know, of the moment. It's from like, you know, 1900.
Sure.
It takes place in brothels.
Okay.
And the flowers are the women who are in the brothels.
Gotcha.
There is a love triangle story involving him and two of the women. Another storyline involves one of the women negotiating her freedom from the brothel. Because how they functioned then was that an older woman, who is referred to as an auntie, she buys children. Out of poverty.
I see.
And takes them to the brothel where they are educated, fed, clothed, and taken care of until they are old enough to work. Ah. They are essentially slaves. Mm. And that is how what happened back then. And so what you have here is a luxurious setting where everyone is, you know, kept in beautiful clothing and you know, good food, and but
oppressed.
But yes. So what happens in the film is that a handful of stories about the women and the men that they are working with and for.
Okay.
Sort of overlap here and there, and there's sort of these episodic loops that sort of slowly cross over each other. Now, what we saw when you and I saw Hu Hsiao-hsien's film, The Assassin, which is a film in which the assassin herself retreats from that task, this is a film where dalliance has more than one meaning. Where, you know, the sexual involvement that we would refer to as a dalliance becomes sort of a... springboard is too strong a word for a kind of time-wasting that Tony Leung's character finds himself in. He is sitting around doing not much. He moves between women, the two women, in a very hesitant, conflicted manner. And this is, you know, maddening for the women themselves. So all the action that one might expect from this story that would involve, you know, clear plot points in any other sort of mainstream film. That stuff does not come to pass.
Right.
There are these sort of explicitly nuts and bolts conversational exchanges that take place between the women, mostly about their positions in the houses,
mm-hmm.
Ideas about gratitude toward the auntie, the money that they need to buy their own freedom and leave.
Right.
You know, because... So there's one scene. It's the one scene where people are sort of arguing. One of the aunties sort of argues, sort of scolds one of the women that Tony Leung is involved with. And she's scolding her for wanting too much. He's like, I treated you like my own child. I combed your hair. I bound your feet. And basically, and this is the thanks I get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in spite of the fact that the women are slaves, they are also intimately involved with each other's lives and with the life of the auntie, who really does become sort of a strange parental figure for them.
Yeah.
And they... they act out, you know, the girlfriend experience for the men. They become involved with their suitors in such a way as to be, you know, maybe even exclusively patronized by this one man for several years until perhaps he will marry her.
But he would have to pay the aunt.
But he would have to buy her out of that situation. So... You know, we hear more about this action than we see it. You know, the characters make small passing reference to the events that are transpiring, but we know what we know because the environment that they live in. It's not easily packaged for outsiders.
Have you seen Pretty Baby by chance?
I have never seen Pretty Baby, and the thought of seeing it sort of makes my stomach hurt, and I don't know that I want to.
I'm just curious because it's very much that this same kind of thing in terms of it's very insular,
yes,
and it has its own set of rules and expectations.
I think my hesitancy with Pretty Baby is that it stars an actual 10-year-old,
yes,
and this is, you know, adults who we learn have been part of the brothel since they were children.
Sure,
yeah. You know,
no, I've only seen it because Polly Platt wrote it,
right,
and came to Dallas to do a screening after, right, Louis Malle died.
So what's interesting about the plot of this is that you are never quite sure where real love is entering into the picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Tony Leung's character is completely melancholy throughout. And you see on his face the idea of, how did I get myself into this? You know, how is it that I'm dealing with two women at the same time that would only begin loving me because I'm a paying customer? And, you know, who's real here? Should I simply go, you know, or should I stay? And what it boils down to is that you have a group of men who are behaving in ways that they were taught to behave.
Right.
And a group of women who observe very rigid behavioral codes for a job,
yeah,
that they are forced to do.
Mm.
And who, even if they get to leave with one of the customers that has courted them for a few years, they will still
exchanging it for a different kind of...
They're exchanging it for a different kind of service to the same guy.
Right.
Although, you know, ostensibly free. Now, all of that is much more explication than the film,
gotcha,
likes to give you. Hu Hsiao-hsien is less interested in telling you why a character is behaving like this, what their, you know, backstory is, to use that word, than he is with every other element of the filmmaking process, every other formal element that is really what's telling the story. So there's this, it's this quietly humming, you know, exercise in tone and formal approaches that highlight the interactions between people for whom money is the guiding principle. It is also one of the most gorgeous things I've ever seen in my life. Now, I approached this movie already knowing that film critics have called it a masterpiece for 20 years. But I had not seen it. So, you know, when you get that in your head, when you walk into it and you say, oh, everyone says this is a masterpiece.
Prove it, movie.
We'll see.
Yeah.
holy cow. It is so beautiful. It is entirely lit. It's entirely studio bound. Mm-hmm. Every scene is inside. Every room is lit by oil lamps.
Oh.
The scenes fade in and fade out to black. Mm. And the lamps are what you see first and what you see last. And it is such an incredibly beautiful moment that you forget for a while that it's about something ugly.
Right.
You have to keep reminding yourself that it's about something ugly, because the womb-like condition of this place mm-hmm. is itself the reason the men are attracted to it and keep coming back. It's this cocoon where all the rules are set out for them, and all they need to get what they want is money. Now, I cannot begin to explain the details of turn of the 20th century Shanghai, or how people lived, or even specifically how people lived in this kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, here the men seem to be behaving in the ways that that culture taught them to behave,
right.
And the women behave in ways that they need to behave in order to get by,
right?
In order to live,
yeah.
In order not to be beaten or thrown out onto the street. In conclusion, you know, Hu Xiaoxian's one of my favorite filmmakers, and what I learn every time I see one of his films is that I need to see it again.
Mm.
And each reviewing is it deepens the experience. He's one of the world's great filmmakers, and this is an astonishing film.
Where does it fall in his like early, late
98?
Right, but I mean for him.
Oh, well, I mean like early stuff from the 80s, it's like mid, you know, because he's still making movies.
Right, no, I know.
So, yeah.
I don't know if it was his first movie or...
No. The Time to Live and the Time to Die and stuff that came before that, that's all from the 80s.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Oh, and you're watching The Time to Live and the Time to Die.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you are. It's on Amazon Prime. Anybody can go look at it right now if they want to, if they got Amazon Prime.
Lots of things are on Amazon Prime.
Well, that's one. Hey, let's talk about Amber Petty.
Oh, yes.
She's an advertiser.
She is.
Are you a writer? Amber Petty is a freelance writing teacher and a coach. She helps actors and creatives find side jobs they don't hate. And she has made you a helpful list.
Mm.
Get the big list of paying publications that take pitches. This is a list of 230 publications that are open to freelancers, and they pay actual money. Almost every entry directs to the company's pitching guidelines or masthead, so you spend less time hunting down editor info. This list is free.
What?
It's not going to cost you a penny. Just go to amberpetty.com/linoleum. Sign up. You get your list of paying publications for zero amounts of money.
Well...
She's also giving away free 30-minute coaching sessions.
Oh, man. This deal just
gets
better.
You can get two free things. Go to amberpetty.com/linoleum.
I don't see why you shouldn't. Good heavens.
Well, if you don't want to be a freelance writer, you shouldn't.
Well, I suppose.
But if you do want to be a freelance writer and you would like to get paid, you can do these things.
You ought to.
Apparently, this list tells you who actually will pay you.
That is magic information.
Because that is the most magical information that you can get. Who pays you? Who pays you on time? Who you have to chase down for a year to get your money? Advocate. Out. Advocate magazine. Out magazine. Chase them down for a year to get your money. by the way.
Well, that was our experience the last time we wrote for them, which was a decade
2010.
Ago.
2010. You think it's gotten better?
I have no idea.
I heard it hasn't.
I couldn't say firsthand because we stopped writing for them after that happened.
You know what? Anybody who's written for The Advocate or Out in the past 10 years, if you got paid on time, I would love to hear from you. I had to chase them down for a year, and I don't care that I'm saying this in public. I will ishtalk any former employer who treated me badly.
Fair enough.
Movies.com. I'm in a mood.
Go to amberbetty.com/linoleum.
Yeah.
Well, while you're in a mood, I think we should talk about love, weddings, and other disasters.
Oh, I thought we were done talking about movies, and now we're going to talk about... Okay, the world is a place where Flowers of Shanghai exists. And it is also a place where this thing exists. I hesitate to call it a film or a movie. It is only with great charity and an expanded definition of the word that you could call it cinema.
And just to be...
As they say on Letterkenny, it's effing embarrassing.
Yeah. And just to be clear from the get-go, do not take this and think, oh, this is so terrible. That sounds like something I have to see.
So bad it's good.
No, it's just so bad.
That is not, it's not what this is. This
it's
is
so,
not
bad,
so bad
it's life-draining.
That's right. Talk about it. Ugh. I can't.
Dennis Dugan.
Who should be ashamed of himself.
If he's even capable at this point in his career, he's already given us a multitude of Adam Sandler movies. He's the guy who directed both Grown Ups movies and Jack and Jill. And I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry.
Yeah.
So this is his attempt to do basically a late career Gary Marshall movie, like, you know, Valentine's Day or New Year's Day or Mother's Day.
All the days. Right.
Where it's a bunch of overlapping storylines. Only none of them are interesting. So this one you have Maggie Grace, who I was...
Remember that wig that she had to wear in that movie a few years back? And it was just a sad, big thing sitting on top of her head that no one helped her with. What was that movie?
I don't know.
I'm going to go look at
the
title. I
remember there was a Maggie Grace wig.
She's wearing other terrible wigs in this movie. Why don't you keep talking? I'm going to go look up the
name of
that movie.
For the first 5 or 10 minutes, I was convinced
it was... Feels so bad for Maggie Grace.
I was convinced it was Penelope Ann Miller, but no, it was Maggie Grace. She is a would-be wedding planner, but is unfortunately famous on the internet for having skydived into a lakeside wedding and plunging the bride into the water. So her current client is this guy who is running for mayor of Boston. His brother is currently on some terrible-looking game show hosted by somebody played by Dennis Dugan that looks like cruddy public access, but we're later told is like a hit show on TBS, where he has to spend a week chained to a woman who claims to be an attorney, but she's actually a stripper. Ha-ha. The Maggie Grace's wedding planner runs afoul of a snooty, exacting caterer played by Jeremy Irons, who gets set up on a blind date with Diane Keaton, who is blind. Ha ha, these are the jokes.
The Choice.
Choice.
Nicholas Sparks movie.
Yes, okay.
Makes you feel so bad for Maggie Grace.
Diane Keaton spends most of the movie with a seeing eye dog that keeps running her into things. And Jeremy Irons...
That's not what they do. They're trained not to do that.
Jeremy Irons has sex with her and then rearranges the furniture in her apartment because it doesn't occur to her that, oh yeah, she's blind.
Doesn't occur to him.
Also, he leaves her a note because it doesn't occur to her that, oh yeah, to him that, oh yeah, she's blind. There's also...
It's hideous. It's just...
There's a tour boat guide played by King Batch, and he's totally not funny and wouldn't pass muster on the Jungle Cruise at Disneyland.
Right.
But everybody thinks that he's just hilarious, so much so that a local news story does it. Anyway.
You don't need to tell all the different
threads. This movie is ugly looking. There's not a laugh in it. You feel cringingly embarrassed for everybody involved, especially Diane Keaton and Jeremy Irons. Like,
it's offensive.
If you think that winning an Academy Award means that you're never going to have to make movies like this, apparently not. Apparently, even with that statuette in your back pocket, these are the scripts you get offered and say yes to.
Yep.
It's appalling. If I see a worse movie between now and the end of the year...
The rest of your life.
Well, but I'm just saying, like, if this isn't the worst film of 2020, then I can't... I don't even want to wrap my mind around that thought. So let's just say it's the worst film of 2020. Ugh. Is that the movies? Did we cover the list?
We're done. We're done with everything.
Okay, so, no, we have letters.
Oh, you're right.
We have letters. We have a 5-star review. We have so much more excitement. Don't go anywhere. Before we get to letters, we have DVD picks. And before we get to DVD picks, I want to remind you that we have a Patreon.
Yep, we do.
At patreon.com/linoleumknife. Extra content, extra episodes of other things where we talk about one movie for the course of 20 minutes or so. Where we talk about television, where we talk about food.
Where we talk about other topics. Patreon.com/linoleum.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Linoleum knife.
Patreon.com/linoleum knife.
Yes.
That's where you go to find it.
Won't you?
I have a DVD pick.
Uh-huh.
It's another bad Maggie Grace movie.
Oh, dear.
But it's a bad Maggie Grace movie that you're going to love watching.
What's that?
Hurricane Heist.
Oh, right. Oh, God. I always forget she's in that.
Hurricane Heist. It's terrible.
It is.
It's like so stupid and terrible.
Yeah.
And yet, remember when we went to the Grove, we sat in the movie theater and we watched it and we were like, what's happening? Remember how pleasurable that was?
Yeah.
That's why I want to go back to movie theaters.
For experiences someday. Like that one.
It's just good.
It is. Yeah. Love Weddings of the Disasters.
Eat a pretzel while you're doing it.
Is so bad it's bad. Hurricane Heist is kind of so bad it's good. So, yeah, that's a good choice. Mine is an obscure American film called Citizen Kane.
Oh, yeah.
Because, hey, look, it's on everybody's lips right now.
Right.
There's never a bad time to watch it again. I like to get back to it at least once a year. Fun stuff.
Would you like to hear the reviews and the stuff?
Please.
All right. We have a 5-star review.
Yay.
Insightful commentary about life, love, and baking from a married couple who also offer film reviews. This is from Dorn Biker.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to assume that first sentence is a joke. Just playing a little, be a little playful, playfully joking around.
Poetic license.
Yeah. We're very serious and important film critics. Sometimes we talk about other things like
sure, Jan.
Like my baking. Anyway, I found it, the review continues. I found it through, I'm criticizing a 5-star review.
Yeah, how dare you?
Yeah. I found it through the much missed What the Flick, now Breakfast All Day. I appreciate Dave's global approach to cinema, which led me to a donkey film, among others. Great, intelligent talk about important art form.
Oh, well, thank you, Dorn Biker.
Thank you, Dorn Biker.
We appreciate it.
Scrolling up with more letter stuff happening. Here we go. This is from Lauren. I haven't watched the new version of The Secret Garden yet, but I fully intend to after hearing your review. However, when Alonso mentioned that this is a film that is not afraid to terrify children, I was reminded of the 1987 Hallmark version that I grew up with. As a child, I didn't grasp that everyone was dying of cholera, but I did understand that all of the adults died in a fairly gruesome manner. There's a scene where Mary enters her parents' bedroom complaining that there's no one to dress her because the servants are dead. This may have been my first experience with an unlikable heroine who is still sympathetic. The camera pans over her father and mother, who are seconds away from death and who already look like corpses. Later, as soldiers drag her away, Mary drops her doll, and someone tosses it onto a bonfire while Mary screams. It's definitely one of the more unsettling scenes I watched as a kid. I didn't know if the movie holds up now. I don't know if the movie holds up now, but I enjoyed it enough that I avoided the 1993 version when it came out. Also, it features Colin Firth as the adult Colin Craven. Thanks for all you do. That 1993... one is
so good.
Is so great.
Yeah.
Next one. Next letter says, it's from Tony. wanted to share a couple of things about Mayor Marty Walsh.
Oh.
Now, he is the...
The star.
The star, as it were, of Frederick Wiseman's...
City Hall.
...documentary City Hall. One's a good one and one's a bad one.
Okay.
Bits of information.
We wanted to know.
Negative one first. I lived in Boston proper when he first ran for mayor in 2013. Walsh is Boston-born and bred. His opponent was a city councilor who had come to Boston for college and stayed afterward. Both were progressive and had pretty similar goals and policy proposals, so to distinguish himself, Walsh's campaign made the election about old salt of the earth Boston, Walsh, versus new elitist Boston, the opponent. The campaign took on and stoked an anti-elitist sentiment that rubbed me the wrong way and hinted at what was to come nationally. I voted for the other guy. But of course, Walsh won. That said, he's been a decent and hardworking mayor and pretty progressive. Secondly, he was a guest and honoree at my nonprofit company's fundraising gala a few years ago. One speaker was a young boy who got lost in his notes and stumbled on stage for a little while. Was that kid named Dave White? That's the story of my life.
Someone's biting your rhyme.
Anyway, it was excruciating. Everyone wanted to jump on stage and help the kid. Walsh was up next and immediately set things right. He praised the boy's accomplishments and led the crowd in another round of applause.
Aww.
The boy, still on stage, was beaming. It sounds simple, but I was impressed with Walsh's skill with the boy and the crowd. He's a total pro.
That's the impression you get from the film.
Yeah.
He knows what he's doing. And he knows how to connect to people both individually and in groups.
Comment from Andrew, who says, look up Frank Zappa's appearance on Crossfire. It's worth a watch. I wish he were alive today.
Mm.
That's in reference to the Frank Zappa documentary that we talked about last time.
I think you get a brief taste of that in the movie. But yeah, I'm sure the whole thing
you get
it's him and like a lot Pat of, Buchanan, right?
Yeah, you get a lot of him on various news programs in the 80s. So yeah. One of them was probably from that Crossfire. Yeah. Yeah. And now we are done.
All right. Yeah. Well, thanks for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. Dave and I are on the current episode of All Things Cozy.
We are.
Talking about Happiest Season and the Hallmark film The Christmas House and about... Christmas,
that's right. Christmas, I watched a Hallmark movie.
You did. Christmas coziness in general. So give that a listen. See what Bibbs and Whitney are up to over at Critically Acclaimed. Listen to The Schmoes Know. Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon. Sewers of Paris. Deck the Hallmark. Big Fat Gay Podcast. Fat Guys at the Movies. The Criterion Cast. And Secretly Timid. Also, I was on the recent episode of Secretly Soundtracks talking about the music of the film Scrooge, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review or read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, Amazon Music, CastBox, Podbean. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. See what he's up to over on Twitter at Blutopia, BLEUTOPIA. And that's it for now. We'll be back next week with more. And until then,
goodbye.